It's Wednesday, October 27, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. With the midterm elections coming in just a few days, there is interesting news all around. But I was particularly struck by a story in The Guardian and another international media indicating that liberal financier George Soros has given $1 million to California's pro-marijuana campaign. That is, the campaign to adopt what is known as Proposition 19, a proposition that would legalize all adults for possessing no more than 1 ounce of marijuana. It basically amounts to the legalization of marijuana in terms of personal possession and small-scale sale. Now, the issue of marijuana has become a dividing line between the state of California with other states that are joining it in terms of a pro-cannabis movement on one side, with the federal government on the other side. The bottom line in that particular conflict is that the federal government, even with the Obama administration and Attorney General Eric Holder, is holding the line when it comes to prosecuting all cases related to the criminal use and possession of marijuana or other narcotics and drugs. Now, Charles Blow in the New York Times last week accused the Democrats of running a pro-crime-busting campaign in an effort to boost their arrest statistics, while it leads to a disproportionate number of arrests of young black men who actually use marijuana at lower rates than do white young people, but are arrested at higher rates because it is generally an arrest along with other legal issues. Now, all that aside, what this really leads to in terms of a focus upon George Soros's investment is the fact that this particular financier was a $3 million investor in the previous effort to legalize medical marijuana. Now, I'm not sure exactly what George Soros has in this, other than that there's a basic libertarian streak when it comes to narcotics. We should note that on the legalization of some drugs, there is an interesting breakdown. It's not just the traditional liberal and conservative divide. Libertarians, who often vote with conservatives on economic issues and small government, want the decriminalization not only of marijuana, but of many other illegal substances as well. Many liberals have chosen the issue of drugs as a place to draw the line in a so-called war on crime. So as we're looking at this issue, it's hard to know exactly how this lays out in terms of the liberal-conservative divide, but one of the interesting things to note is that, as one commentator said, the grown-ups seem to be showing up now in California, where support for Proposition 19 appears to be decreasing rather than growing. Remember as well that this is California, where one of the arguments against Proposition 19 has been air pollution, because this will lead to increased smoking of marijuana in public. When it comes to some of these issues, especially referenda that show up like California's notorious propositions, well, the silly season just seems to get sillier. The punishment of war criminals has been something of a moral achievement in the 20th century. The famed Nuremberg trials were, as legal historians will attest, the first major international effort to hold persons who had held government office to account for the atrocities and genocide that were conducted under their reign. On Tuesday, news came from Iraq that former Saddam Hussein deputy Tariq Aziz has been sentenced to death for his killing of members of the Shia parties that took place after the first Gulf War. Now, there are many different aspects to this account, but one of them is the moral imperative that these atrocities actually do find their day in court, and that those who are responsible for them are indeed brought before the bar of justice. Now, another interesting thing to note is that Tariq Aziz, in terms of his defense, sounded just like the arrested Nazis at the Nuremberg trial. Let me quote to you from his statement. He said, "All decisions were taken by President Saddam Hussein. I held a political position. I did not participate in any of the crimes that were raised against me personally. Being a member of the government, I had a moral responsibility to defend the government." End quote. In other words, as so many of the Germans said, "I was just taking orders." An interesting juxtaposition to that story comes with reference to Nazi Germany in a story that appeared in yesterday's edition of the Wall Street Journal. The German Foreign Ministry has done an enormous self-search and investigation, and now reveals that the Foreign Service and its officers were heavily involved in the Holocaust. Now, if this doesn't come as news to you, you need to recognize that the German government has for years, along with the larger German society, held to the mythology that the German Foreign Ministry was somehow immune from the moral atrocities of the Nazi regime. They conceded that Joachim von Ribbentrop, the Nazi foreign minister, was a war criminal. You'll remember that he was executed after being found guilty of war crimes at Nuremberg and sentenced to death. But the thought had been indeed a cherished thought to the German people, that the foreign ministry was made up of aristocrats and foreign policy experts who would never have given themselves to something as unspeakably horrible and immoral as the Holocaust. But now, as Vanessa Furman reports in the Wall Street Journal, a government-sponsored commission has concluded that the Nazi-era foreign ministry was complicit in the murder of millions of European Jews. According to her report, the 880-page document that was conducted and commissioned by the foreign ministry has dismantled a myth preserved for decades in Germany that the Third Reich diplomats on the whole opposed the Nazis or at least played no active role in the Holocaust. On the contrary, as she writes, the foreign ministry was an active participant in the Nazis' policy of violence from the beginning. That kind of moral revisionism is just what is needed if any society is to be honest about its own past. It should tell us something about human nature, that the first real reckoning on many of the issues of Nazi Germany is now coming some six decades after the end of the war and the fall of that regime. Also in the Wall Street Journal, Melinda Beck reports that scientists are now seeking proof in documenting cases of near-death claims. I was surprised by the scale of this. According to her report, 15 million American adults say they have had a near-death experience. That's dated back to a 1997 survey. Medical researchers aren't exactly sure what to do with these claims, and that's why, for the first time, medical experts are beginning to look at the question. Now, another thing that is documented in this article is that so many of these persons indicate a very similar pattern of experience. They speak of a bright light. They speak of the experience of going through a tunnel. Now, I was somewhat curious when I read this article and found that some scientists are conjecturing that in the great rush of hormones and chemicals that may come to the brain at death, there's a recapitulation of birth and going through a tunnel. It probably doesn't take much medical science to come up with something like that. On the other hand, they have found that high levels of carbon dioxide that are very consistent with seeing bright lights are often found as the brain heads toward death. Now, what do Christians do with all this? Well, for one thing, we should be very dubious about all of these stories, and especially about the revelations that supposedly come to those who have this kind of experience. Biblical Christianity is based upon the data of the Scriptures, not the kind of anecdotal evidence that comes back from persons who have claimed this revelation or that, including now those who claim to have been near death and have returned. A great deal of attention has been directed in recent years to falling birth rates in much of the world, and especially in Western Europe. Now, Jean-Claude Barreau, writing in Le Figaro of Paris, reports that France is the only country in Europe that is actually making enough babies to keep its population levels balanced. Now, as he writes in Le Figaro, he explains that France is alone, actually singular, in Europe in terms of reversing a trend of low birth rate. French women are now having an average of two babies each. This will lead to the fact that France, in 15 years or less, will become the most populous nation in Europe, a status it has not held since the French Revolution. But as he continues his article, he makes a very fascinating comment. He compares the birth rates in France, which is now largely secular, to the birth rates of Poland and Italy and Spain. Traditionally Catholic countries, you would expect, would have a higher birth rate. But as he points out, in France, a good deal of the birth rate is attributable to births out of wedlock. Well, let me just let you hear the argument from Mr. Barreau himself. He says this: for some of these countries, the culprit with falling birth rates is Catholicism, which once contributed to high birth rates, but now does the opposite. Spanish, Italian, and Polish women are no longer sufficiently Catholic to get married, but they are still too Catholic to have children out of wedlock. He writes, French women, by contrast, have shed their Catholic guilt, with the result that now a majority of French babies are born out of wedlock. In other countries such as Germany and the United Kingdom, women are forced to choose between maternity and a career, he writes, but that simply isn't the case in France. Now, I've seen many interesting arguments in coming to terms with falling birth rates and the exceptions such as France, but I'll be honest, this one takes the cake. Speaking of newspapers, both the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times on Tuesday were out with major stories documenting the loss of circulation experienced by major American news dailies. The newspapers have been suffering in recent years. Last year was an out-and-out catastrophe. This year, it turns out that the loss of subscriptions is only, you have to underline the word only, about half of what it was last year. The decline last year was 10.6%. Now, this time, it's just about 5%. Two newspapers are growing. Those two newspapers are the Wall Street Journal and the Dallas Morning News. There's also now a battle between the Wall Street Journal and USA Today as to which paper has the largest national daily circulation. It looks like the numbers go to the Wall Street Journal, which has a growing circulation, but there's a case to be made for USA Today, although it has experienced a declining circulation. Is the day of the newspaper over? Not hardly. The reports indicate that a good number of newspaper readers have migrated to the iPad and to the internet, but there's still something about holding the newspaper in the hand. As I speak to you right now, I have both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal articles, as printed on newsprint, in my hand. Even though the same data is available on the internet, and to be honest, I probably read at least part of these articles first on the internet, there's still nothing quite like holding a newspaper in hand. I, for one, hope that the death of the newspaper is at least partly exaggerated. But, looking at the statistics, I have to fear that on that count, I might be wrong. At my website at albertmoeller.com today, you'll find an article in which I deal with an argument put forth by Stanley Hauerwas, the provocateur professor of divinity at Duke's Divinity School, in which he argues in The Guardian, which is a leftist British newspaper, that Americans are not so religious as they seem. Now, the argument Stanley Hauerwas makes is provocative and it ought to have our attention. As a matter of fact, we will find ourselves in fundamental agreement with much of what he has to say. Now, the background to all of this is the election of Ed Miliband as the new leader of the Labour Party. Now, the Labour Party is, of course, the party that was recently in power, but is now the minority power out of government in Great Britain. But its new leader, Ed Miliband, one of two brothers who vied for the position, is an avowed atheist who is cohabitating with a woman. Now, a good number of observers have noted that that might be possible in Great Britain, but not in the United States. These same analysts have suggested that America is just too religious a country, specifically too Christian, in order to put up with this. Stanley Hauerwas will have nothing with the argument. He writes that in his view, even though Americans attend church at rates that are spectacularly higher than those in Britain, even though Americans report religious beliefs that are a quantum of what is found in Great Britain, he says that Americans are really quite secular because most of them hold to a form of what we would call civil religion. They actually believe in belief. They actually believe in a freedom that is a part of the American ethos far more than they believe in any kind of God, any serious theism. Now, in my article, I agree with Professor Hauerwas that we need to detect the difference between civil religion and authentic Christian faith. But when I read Stanley Hauerwas in his articles and in his books, I feel that there is a deep disparagement of the actual authentic faith of so many people in the pews. We may not be all theologians, but that doesn't mean that they're not authentic believers in Christ. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to Twitter/Albert Moeller. For more information on Southern Seminary, go to sbts.edu. I'll be back with you tomorrow for The Briefing.